Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
To the list of institutions that might be too big to fail, allow me to add yet one more. The great state of California. As of our budget referendum last night, $21 billion in the hole and counting. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conservemore.com. American Public Media presents The Next American Dream. What will it look like? Find out more at nextamericandream.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Wednesday, the 20th of May today. Glad to have you with us. The debate about whether or not California is too big to fail could actually be framed another way, if you like. Whether it's too dysfunctional to stay out of default. Yesterday, voters here defeated a series of ballot measures that would have helped put the state's would have helped the state balance its completely out of balance budget. A couple of months ago, California's deficit was $40 billion. After much, and I do mean much, back and forth between the governor and state lawmakers, they filled that hole, only to tell voters 2 weeks later that they were somehow $15 billion short again. After yesterday's vote, the gap now looks like it's going to be about $21 billion. With nearly 500,000 state and municipal workers, California is kind of like the General Motors of states, which gets us back to the original question. Is it too big to, you know? Here's Stacey Vanek Smith.
Back during the internet boom, cash was flowing, and California was in a spending frenzy, cutting taxes, creating programs. Then the boom went bust, and state politicians have spent the last 10 years arguing over whether to plug the budget shortfall with higher taxes or program cuts. Yeah. 10 years. Susan Uran is the managing director of the Pew Center on the States. She says when the recession hit, things got really bad.
You have the biggest budget gap right now. You have the fourth highest unemployment rate in the country. Not a lot of discipline on spending. You know, bad housing crisis.
And a system of ballot initiatives that has let small groups of voters and politicians paralyze California's legislature. Enter a $20 billion budget shortfall.
Whether it's tax increases or cuts in programs that are really going to be to the bone, they will balance their budgets.
That could mean a shorter school year, releasing 40,000 prisoners, and slashing Medicaid. And that has some Californians talking about tapping everybody's favorite new ATM, the U.S. Treasury. California economist Stephen Levy.
We wouldn't be asking for a bailout as much as one of the federally guaranteed loans that the federal government is giving to virtually everybody now.
If that doesn't happen, Levy says Governor Schwarzenegger and lawmakers will somehow have to terminate 10 years of arguing and make some really hard decisions.
If there were a Terminator, then someone could come in and settle it.
A new Terminator debuts on the big screen this weekend. Unfortunately, he seems preoccupied with killer robots. In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Assuming that he's going to have to borrow a lot of money from somebody, this next item will come as sweet music to Governor Schwarzenegger. There were new signs today that the credit markets are thawing even further. The London Interbank Offered Rate, LIBOR, in the vernacular, fell to a new low. LIBOR is the rate that banks have to pay each other to borrow, and it's also a good measure of how willing they are to lend to the rest of us. One of the things sending LIBOR lower today was the word that Bank of America has raised more than $13 billion by selling some stock. That'll go a long way toward raising B of A's cash cushion that the stress tests required. So, with all this good news in the banking sector and the race by some of the big banks to pay back their government bailout money on the theory that they don't need it anymore, where is the credit for consumers? Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has that story from New York.
For the 30,000-foot view, I went to Chris Lowe, who works just off the trading floor at FTN Financial in Midtown Manhattan. Here's his assessment of the credit markets.
They're getting better, and that in itself is a huge step.
He says banks can borrow cheaply from one another now, knowing that various governments are backing them up. But many ordinary Americans still can't get loans, mortgages, or in some cases, even credit cards. One reason, Lowe says, is that not all banks are getting the same kind of support from Uncle Sam.
There are 8,000 banks in the U.S., and if you look at all the community banks, they're not getting any help.
Okay, but what about the big banks, the ones that are getting help?
They are hoarding cash because they want to pay the government back as fast as they can.
And there's another reason consumers aren't sharing in the free-flowing credit, says John Lonsky. He's chief economist at Moody's Capital Markets Group. He says banks don't want to lend to consumers because they're not sure they'll get their money back.
Consumers are still viewed as being risky, mostly because of a very poor outlook for employment as well as income.
In other words, just in case the economy stays in recession for a while, banks are being careful about who they lend to. And Chris Lowe says that may not be a bad thing.
A big part of the credit bubble bursting was the fact that consumers couldn't service the debt they already have. It doesn't make sense to extend a whole lot of additional credit because, again, we'll be in the same place where they can't afford to pay it back.
Lowe says the responsible restart of consumer lending in this country could take 4 to 5 years. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
One final word on the finance industry today. It comes from none other than Timothy Geithner. The Treasury Secretary told the Senate Banking Committee this morning that banks are, quote, starting to heal. In the high-stakes world of college admissions, there is probably nothing with higher stakes than the SAT. That's why parents shell out millions of dollars for those test prep courses every year, hoping it'll give their kids an advantage. But a new report out today says there may not be that much of an advantage after all. From Washington, Tamara Keith has more.
The National Association of College Admissions Counseling hopes its report chills the SAT prep business.
There needs to be a buyer beware notice for students and families who are thinking about commercial test preparation.
The group's David Hawkins says the report pulled together academic studies about the effectiveness of SAT preparation. It found that the average score increase as a result of the prep courses is 30 points.
Preparing for the test is a good idea. Perhaps investing large sums of money in that preparation may not be as good of an idea because, as the research suggests, you can probably get similar increases just by doing some self-study.
The courses and private tutoring can cost several thousand dollars, as opposed to 30 or so for a study guide. But students and parents must think it's worth it because they keep paying. Kristen Campbell is the National Director of College Prep Programs at Kaplan.
Our families continue to come to us and tell us that preparing with us helps and that we're able to help them achieve their dreams and their scores.
The report also found that a significant number of universities use hard SAT cutoffs in admissions. So just a few points could mean the difference between getting in or not. And ironically, that bit of information could actually provide a boost to the test preparation industry. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
Wall Street got what you might call a gentleman's C. Today, we will have the details when we do the numbers. Political debates in Washington are a dime a dozen, if not cheaper, but the one that Congress is gearing up for now is a biggie. This sounds a bit grand, but it's basically going to be about how capitalism ought to work. How should banks and hedge funds be regulated? How and how well should executives be compensated? And what should the government do to protect the public from the crisis that we're living through now ever happening again? We asked Marketplace's Steve Henn to see how negotiations might play out.
It's mostly behind the scenes right now, but it's shaping up to be a big, nasty fight. Imagine for a second you're a consumer advocate like Ed Merzwinski from the U.S. Public Interest Research Group. You're convinced whacked-out executive pay incentives on Wall Street encouraged the risk-taking that led to this crisis.
Calling it executive pay is almost a misnomer because junior bankers were receiving million-dollar bonuses.
If you're Ed, in your corner you've got 200 million angry Americans and lots of financial heavyweights. So you might think putting some limits on how Wall Street structures paychecks would be a slam dunk. But just imagine for a second who you're up against.
It will be every major and minor business industry in every publicly traded company.
Scott Talbot is a lobbyist with the Financial Services Roundtable. He acknowledges that bonus incentives were a problem, but
we think that the best place to set compensation is by compensation boards.
In other words, let the boards of directors decide. And most high-tech, pharmaceutical, and oil industry executives agree. And this is just one relatively minor issue in a package of reforms the administration's considering, including Harvard Law professor Elizabeth Warren's idea for a commission to protect consumers from deceptive mortgages and credit cards.
Those consumer financial products, ultimately, the dangerous ones, the ones full of tricks and traps, they destabilize this entire economic system.
The financial service industry hates the idea of a consumer product safety commission for banks, so it's lining up against it. Lobbyists like Talbot argue a new consumer advocate isn't necessary.
I would think that the Fed considers the consumer angle in everything that they do. They have to. That's their role as the regulator for the financial institution.
But consumer advocates like Ed Mrozwinski say the Fed failed in that role.
And the Federal Reserve blew it, and they blew it badly.
Mrozwinski says not only did the Fed not protect consumers, it didn't keep the system stable either.
Plain and simple, the Federal Reserve is unaccountable to the public. And that may be good for monetary policy, but it's not good for risk.
Still, the big financial services companies are pushing Congress to make the Fed the overarching regulator for the financial industry, responsible for stopping threats to the entire system. And that will be another big fight. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Democratic leaders in the House have been promising a vote on climate change legislation by the end of the week. According to a Reuters poll out today, they've got enough votes to get the package to the floor anyway. If it does pass, and if it does make it by the Senate, the bill would gradually cut greenhouse gas emissions over the next decade or so. The centerpiece of the whole thing is it's a business model, really, that's known as cap and trade. It's a term we hear all the time, but one that doesn't make much sense without some explanation. So, Sarah Gardner's here from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk to help us understand. Hey, Sarah.
Hi, Kai.
All right, let's start with the beginning of this thing, the cap part. What is being capped under cap and trade?
Well, the idea is to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide we put out into the atmosphere.
Right.
So Congress would cap or limit the total amount of greenhouse gas emissions every year.
All right. And trade?
The trade part. What's traded are the rights to emit those greenhouse gases under the legal limits.
Okay, how do you trade a right, though? I mean, you can trade oil, you can trade stocks. Trading a right, I don't get it.
Okay, well, you can think of that right as, say, a license to pollute, and then you just turn that license into a tradable commodity, like you said, just like oil or pork bellies. And major polluters will receive some of these carbon permits for free, but they'll also have to buy some of them at auction. So they'll have these permits in hand, and then they'll be able to start trading them. They will trade them depending on their emissions needs from year to year.
What's the point, though, of trading them?
Instead of a top-down government mandate, the idea is to let the market work and find the cheapest, most efficient way to get to these reductions. Mm-hmm. Here's how it might work. Say you've got Joe's Power and Light Company, and Joe has a fairly new coal-fired power plant, and he needs to run it full steam. He needs more carbon permits.
Because he needs to pollute more.
That's right.
Okay.
He needs to find them on the market. He can then go to the market and buy more carbon permits from, say, Sam's Power and Light, because Sam is perhaps already investing in solar. He's emitting less and he has permits to spare.
Okay. What's the incentive, though, for polluters to eventually clean things up?
Okay, this is key. The emissions cap is going to get tighter and tighter as the years go on.
So there will be right, okay.
There are fewer in circulation, supply shrinks. Theoretically, these permits are getting more expensive. And if you're still out there polluting like crazy, it's going to take a lot of money to keep that up. So there's your incentive to clean up your act.
You know, we're treating this, or Congress is, I suppose, like it's never been done before. Is that true?
No, we have some experience with this. We have a national cap and trade program for sulfur dioxide, which causes acid rain. We've had it since the mid-90s, and it's been very successful. Having said that, the sulfur dioxide problem has been a little simpler. Reducing greenhouse gases involves transitioning to whole new technologies. It's not just adding scrubbers to existing plants. But Kai, no cap-and-trade program is going to work unless politicians are willing to enforce it and let permit prices get high enough so that it changes consumer behavior and corporate behavior. So stay tuned. We'll see what happens.
All right. Sarah Gardner from our sustainability desk on cap-and-trade. If you're the type, by the way, that learns better by seeing than by listening, you should check out our website. Our editor, Patty Hirsch, has put together a video whiteboard of the cap-and-trade system. It's on our website. It's marketplace.org. Sarah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Coming up, Target sticks to high fashion in a down market.
You cannot go up against Walmart and out Walmart Walmart. So by design, we created our strategy, and we've been focused on it for nearly two decades.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 52 points today, about two-thirds of 1%, closed at 8,422, the blue chips did. The NASDAQ dropped 6 points, roughly 0.4%, finished at 1727. The S&P 500 shed 4 points, more than 0.5%, ended the day at 903. News that Congress has finalized new rules on credit cards, sent shares of some banks lower because they need more lower stock shares. J.P. Morgan Chase shed more than 3.5% today. U.S. Bancorp lost more than 2%. Toll Brothers crumbled nearly 2.75% today after the home builder reported a 51% loss in revenue. Wasn't all bad news, though. Analysts left the buy recommendation on McDonald's that gobbled up a gain of 4.4%. A similar nod boosted Procter & Gamble. Shares of the soapmaker scrubbed up 2% today. The New York Stock Exchange welcomed its newest listing, SolarWinds. Shares of the software company debuted today, loaded up 10%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.19%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at Elance.com. And by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. What's the connection between Girl Scout cookies and margin calls? Check out the Marketplace Decoder on our website, marketplace.org. There you'll find videos unwrapping the basics of the financial crisis.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, President Obama is slated to discuss the future of Guantanamo Bay during a speech. The House Education and Labor Committee holds a hearing on student loan reform. And wrestler and actor famed for the television series The A-Team has a birthday. Mr. T will be 57. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Behind the closed doors of the Senate Finance Committee today, beer. Actually, raising beer taxes, another 15 cents a six-pack, if that's of particular interest to you. Congress is trying to find ways to pay for health care reform. Exactly what kind of reform we're going to get is still in the works. There's been a lot of talk about some kind of public-private partnership. But commentator Robert Reich wonders whether there has been too much talk.
I understand politics is the art of compromise, but at the rate we're going with health care, politicians may be giving away the store. Right now, private insurers spend big bucks marketing policies to healthier and younger people while avoiding sicker and older people, rejecting those with pre-existing conditions, and contesting many claims. That's why many experts have long advocated a so-called single-payer system that would instead focus on helping sick people and preventing others from becoming sick, and use its vast bargaining power to negotiate lower prices from drug companies and hospitals. On the campaign trail, Barack Obama pushed a reasonable compromise, a universal health care system that included a public insurance plan resembling Medicare, which members of the public could choose if they wanted. This optional public plan could at least negotiate low prices and pressure private insurers to better serve the public. But the Senate is taking this Medicare-like option off the table, courtesy of heavy lobbying by insurance and drug companies. And the White House is signaling it's open to other approaches. Yet other approaches being considered by the Senate would essentially gut the public plan. One would break it into pieces run by regional third-party administrators, thereby guaranteeing that none would have much bargaining leverage to get low prices. Another would put the public plan under state governments, further eroding it. Big pharma and big insurance already get just about whatever they want from state officials. A third would require that a public plan adhere to private insurance rules. But if their rules private insurers have wangled, the public plan can't possibly push insurers to do better or get good deals from drug companies and medical providers. Maybe the House will come up with a real Medicare-like public option, and Senate Democrats will pass it under a reconciliation bill needing just 51 votes. But this won't happen unless there's huge pressure from the White House and the public. Right now, we're on the way to a universal health care bill that politicians will claim is a big step forward when it's really, at most, a step sideways.
Robert Reich is a professor of public policy at the University of California, Berkeley. Let us know what you think. Write to us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Target reported quarterly earnings today. It notched a 13% decline in profits compared to the same period a year ago. This recession has been tough on retailers, especially ones that aren't named Walmart. But Target has been trying to stay away from the everything you need at low, low prices model. It's trying to get customers in the door with designer goods like Alexander McQueen pants and shabby chic blankets, but just cheaper. Still, though, those discretionary items, they're not selling.
The boss will see you now.
Today on Conversations from the Corner Office, Target CEO Greg Steinhoffel. At the company's Minneapolis headquarters a couple of weeks ago, I asked him when he is going to know the economy's on the mend.
We'll know that it is turning around once discretionary categories perform better in the marketplace. Apparel and home in particular and other discretionary items.
You've actually had a lot of your stock, a lot of your product lines in those discretionary categories. Is this recession making you rethink that balance?
It's not making us rethink the balance as much as it is helping us understand that we've got to have traffic drawing capabilities in any economic environment. Clearly, this is the most challenging consumer environment in the last 50 years. So consumers are just focused more on buying things they need and not what they want. And so one of our priorities are to strengthen our food offering. We've been working on that for some time. We've been adding food.
You know, I wanted to ask you about the food thing because I'm a Target shopper, but when I go in there, I'm looking for socks and maybe toys for the kids and, you know, some car polish or something like that. I'm not looking for a gallon of milk and some Ore-Ida fries. Why food at a store like Target?
Well, to be honest with you, Kai, you're not the average demographic shops in our store. We're highly female-oriented, and those busy moms
I'm a sensitive shopper. I mean,
if you were the grocery shopper in the family, you would be looking at our food assortment.
All right, so let me see if I have this straight. You are working toward price-conscious consumers. You are trying to make it so that customers can get everything they conceivably need at your stores. How are you different from Walmart then?
Well, we have a differentiated strategy from Walmart. We don't aspire to be as large as Walmart. We know that's not going to happen. So we're focused on our demographics, because our demographics are slightly more affluent than the Walmart guest, the slightly more female, they have kids at home, they're slightly better educated. And what we're able to provide is similar to a Walmart. We have all the basic need categories covered. But then we create a different environment on the discretionary side, where we are appealing to a consumer that wants better quality, more fashion, the kinds of items and products you would find in a specialty store environment.
Does it raise your hackles when people call it Target, or are you okay with that?
We love it. We love it.
What happens to this company if you don't time and negotiate the handling of this recession the right way? Is there a big downside risk coming out of this recession for you?
Well, there's a downside of not being a good competitive retailer in any environment. We're in a business where you have to take risks, and you can at times get ahead of yourself and become too aspirational, and there's times where you're not moving fast enough. And that's part of the fun part of the business, is you got to find that sweet spot where you're trend right, you're fashion forward, you have the right kind of content, but you're not too far in front of the market, because if you are, people aren't going to understand what you're trying to sell. On the other hand, if you're post-peak, then you're just selling commodities.
It's crazy making, right? I mean, you have to consistently rejigger to a moving target provided by customers who 8 times out of 10 probably don't know what they really want. Dealing with the American consumer, I think, must be an amazingly frustrating enterprise.
American consumers really do know what they want. They may not know exactly the difference between one particular style and another style, but that's what we do. We are the super editors for our guests. We're giving them the best choices category by category, and over time they trust us to be their editors to make their life simple and easy.
I will just say that for all the journalists out there who may be listening, editors don't always know, right? what's going on. There's a fine line, it seems to me, between you telling us what we want and giving us what we let you know we want, right?
You can look at it a number of different ways. Walmart has a much broader assortment than Target does. They have tens of thousands of more choices. We believe that's confusing. On the other hand, you have Costco and Sam's Club, very, very tightly edited. They have 4,000. Both of those strategies are successful. So choice works because Walmart's successful. Tightly editing assortment works as well.
Is that a phrase you guys actually use, editing?
Yes, we do. We do.
Greg Steinhoffel, Chairman and CEO of Target. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
There's more of my interview with Greg Steinhoffel and conversations from other corner offices at our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, you know how Congress is always passing those huge pieces of legislation, 500 or 1,000 pages thick? Not that they have a history of actually reading them, mind you, but that may be changing. We were talking about the climate change bill earlier. It runs 946 pages. Republicans are threatening to make clerks read the whole thing out loud on the floor of the House, as we should point out is perfectly permissible under the rules. But the clerks know when they're licked. So according to the Wall Street Journal today, they have hired a speed reader. The guy says he can do a page every 34 seconds. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Wednesday afternoon. Today, the Dow dropped 52 points, 0.6%. The NASDAQ lost 6 points, almost 0.4%. Yes. All right, we'll do it for real. That is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 52 points, 0.2%. The NASDAQ shed 6 points, about 0.4%. The S&P 500 tripped down 4 points, more than 0.5% there. Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson-Gewirtz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time on the broadcast, it's the little things that count, even at the fast food counter.
I think it's a time when everybody's looking for a little bit of fun, and little tiny burgers are undeniably cute.
Not very filling, though. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.